Hello and welcome back to the She Who Dares Wins podcast. And my guest today is Stacey Emmons. There you go.
Got it right first time.
Stacey, thanks for coming. And I'm going to hit you off with the first question. She Who Dares Wins. What do those words mean to you? When have you dared and won?
Yeah, good question. Firstly, thank you for the opportunity to be on the podcast. Listen to a few. I think it's great. So
awesome.
Really honoured to be here. So thank you for that. I think, yeah, what does it mean? I think for me, I always kind of go with that, like, what if it goes wrong? That's probably the first thing that comes into my head is, you know, not necessarily what if it goes right. It's kind of like, oh, what if this doesn't work out? Those kind of things. And I think daring is just to kind of push those thoughts to kind of the back of your head and try and go with, well, actually, like, focus on what if this goes right? Like, and wanting to kind of, I guess, try and live my life by not having regrets, by almost being too scared to kind of to take the risk, and trying to live with that sort of mindset of, yeah, hopefully this goes right, and how amazing could it be if it goes right? So for me, that's kind of what it means to me.
So take me back. So you are a coach, right? And take me back to kind of the early stages of your career and what took you on the path to where you are now.
Yeah, no, I think I've always just loved sport. Like when I was younger, I just played all sports. Wanted to be play football. I think my mum first tried to get me to be into ballet, and we've got these videos of me about four. The curtains are opening, all the kids are going doing their dancing, I'm just sat on the floor with like my arms crossed, like refusing. And I think my mum realised at that point, okay, yeah, I'm going to take it to football. So football was always kind of like my kind of main sport and driver. And I think I just wanted to look at like ways that I could kind of continue that. Obviously when I was younger, sort of unlike now where girls can genuinely say, you know, I want to be a professional footballer and that's a career. It wasn't a career at that point. So it's looking at other ways to kind of get some kind of career that kind of related to sport. And for me, that was trying to sort of go to university and take that forward. Came from a single parent family, so my mum didn't really have the funds to kind of support me financially in those ways. She was amazing, did everything she could, but had to kind of look at, you know, what were kind of either scholarships I could apply for and those kind of things. And got a scholarship to Loughborough University in the UK for football, but then there was all the costs of living and all those kind of things, which weren't going to make that possible. But fortunately, I was at the National Women's Football Academy, and there was a number of US scouts that came over, and just really lucky and fortunate that I had like several offers to go out to the US, and two of those were for full scholarships. So not just the degree, but all the housing and everything would be covered. So that was kind of, I guess, the initial step in kind of then everything that's followed.
So just starting out, because like I love football, like, and grew up playing it and never got, same as you, like never got the chance to, but you did get the chance to play because it was always like boys teams. So what were the early years like when you were playing? Did you get to play on girls team? Were there girls teams?
Yeah, and definitely no girls. It was boys teams. So even at school, it was like, you know, we'd go and play another team and it's like, oh, where do we find place for this, you know, the girl to change? It was always kind of like this, yeah. You know, obviously can't get in the boys changing rooms. It was always just boys. And I think I just got used to it really. Like, obviously it's not the ideal scenario, and luckily, hopefully for girls now, there is so many opportunities, which is great. But at the time it was just the norm really to be the one girl sort of within the boys team. And naturally, you know, you'd get comments at times and things like that from either parents and those types of things. But yeah, I guess unfortunately didn't know any different. It was just kind of the norm.
And like America, when, just remembering back to when I was kind of like watching football, they seem to have been so much further ahead, mm-hmm. and in terms of the popularity of the sport. So I guess that's like, was an epic opportunity for you to go over there and play. And like, how did you find the transition? Did you get there and were like, oh my God, these guys, even though it's called soccer, which sucks.
yeah.
Were you like, I found my place? And also like the mindset, like we're talking about dare to win, and you said that that's one of the things that was huge for you was to go to America. Like, what was that like? What was the transition like?
Yeah, it was actually, to be honest, it was like really daunting. I was 18. I'd been away before, but always just been family. I'd never been to America. And anybody I knew who'd been to America or talked about America was like Florida, California. And my mindset was just on football at that point. Like, education obviously was important, but I was going to go to whichever program kind of obviously firstly offered me a full scholarship, but out of the two, all I looked at was who's ranked the highest kind of in the NCAA rankings, and out of that was Ole Miss, which is University of Mississippi.
Oh, wow. I did. Oh, okay.
So actually making a first step, you know, packing a suitcase, transition over to US, get on a flight, don't know anybody. I just got the contact number for the coach that's going to pick me up at the other end. And then arriving in Mississippi was quite a daunting experience.
Yeah.
But just the college system, they call it college in the US, but the university system over there, just for sport in general, is just, I don't think unless you go out and experience it, you can't even comprehend kind of what the Division I schools are like out there. So I even say it now to some young girls, like, despite kind of where the women's game's growing to here and the opportunities for young players, I still think it's such a cool life experience to go and live the US college system and what it's like out there. So I'd still advocate it as an opportunity and experience now.
So you were out there, like, how did you like fit in with the team? Was it a case of you went over there and the level was much higher, or was it just like lots of things to learn? Like, what was it like being on the team?
Yeah, I think the difference within the US and here is the US are athletes, so they produce, you know, from a young age, just playing sports, just a lifestyle out there is, you know, they're generally more athletic. But where they were at, their game understanding, so technical, tactical knowledge of football, was quite poor. So going out there, I think that's what I brought the most, or why they were looking for international players, because I found it baffling that more than half the girls, didn't even watch any form of football or anything outside of playing. So I'd be like getting up at crazy times in the morning to watch Premier League games, and they had even no awareness of kind of like,
wow,
you know, where teams were in the league, who was playing, or even an interest. They were just focused on US sports. So I think that was the biggest difference. That, you know, their athleticism over there. And I think even if you then look at the highest level and how successful the US women's national team have been, obviously there's multiple factors as to why they've been successful. But I think the reason they're getting caught up now is because teams are catching them up in fitness, and the professionalisation of the women's game is developing those athletic qualities. But the game understanding, technically, tactically, is so much more advanced across Europe than in the US. And that's where they now are trying to almost play catch up against
the European
nations.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it is really interesting, because like we'll come on to the explosion, I guess, of European and football in the UK, but that I would have never have figured that, but it completely makes sense.
Yeah.
So the gap between like kind of what you do now and America, how did you get to become a coach and then be at the university with Leeds Beckett doing the work that you do?
Yeah, so I did a full 4 years in the US. Like their college system is obviously a year longer than the UK. And then to be honest, I finished it and I was a bit burnt out. For anyone who has done the college system over there, will be like it is intense. Like we were playing Friday night and then Sunday. That would involve travel, like flights between different destinations. You're trying to do a full-time university degree, but you're training as a full-time player. And it was just so intense that I finished and I felt burnt out. And I just needed some time to, I guess, almost just be like a student a little bit. And
yeah,
not just a party and a drink and those things, but just kind of live and travel a bit. So went out to California, played sort of semi-professional on the team and did a bit of coaching to kind of top that up. But then I wanted to be more of a technical coach as opposed to more like sports science and fitness. So started to do my US qualifications. I was going to do a graduate program in the US, but again, there were 2 years and there was funding associated with that. I was going to have to self-fund. So also applied to come to Leeds Beckett University. Family are in Leeds, and just thought, I was unsure whether I wanted to live in the US or come back home. So I thought, come home for a year and it kind of might help me decide. And at that point, I was thinking I'd come home for a year, get my master's rather than 2 years in the US, and I'd go back.
Right.
That was always a very good attention. And then like 12 years here later, I'm still in Leeds. But now I was really fortunate, as when I was doing my master's, there was an internship advertised as a sports scientist with Leeds United men's professional team. And again, one of those things, I'm not even going to apply for it. Like, it's hard in the women's game anyway. Here's not a chance I'm even going to kind of probably even get an interview for it. And then I was like, okay, no, I'll apply for it. Like, even if you get an interview, that's good experience.
Right.
And then was really fortunate I actually got the internship, and that was really what set me off over here. Got an internship as a sports scientist for like their under-18s kind of reserve team. And then that progressed into a full-time role there. I spent 6 years there and got to lead the academy, so head of sports science for the academy. But then professional football is great, but there's a lot of like downsides to it that people maybe don't as much speak about or advocate. When you're kind of a student, you just see the sort of glitzy glam side of it, but kind of the lack of like work-life balance. It's very kind of 24/7 for 11 months of the year, and there's no boundaries regarding times of day and those kind of things. And then just the how volatile it is in terms of, we had 5 managers within 18 months, and every time it's like, are you going to get the sack as well within that?
Right, because you're on a team.
Because you're part of the team, yeah. Like my boss, who actually was the first one who gave me that opportunity through the master's program, he was at club for 10 years and had a manager come in who just decided to bring his own person in, no other reason other than that. And, you know, he lost his job in that period. And that for me, I just bought a house and those kind of things, and it didn't really sit with kind of what I wanted to do. I juggled doing a full-time PhD while at the club, which I kind of didn't tell the university about. They told me, like, when the PhD, the first day were like, you can finish the season, and then this PhD is full-time, so you kind of need to step away from the club. So I was like, yeah, okay. And then the end of the season came, no one brought it up when I had like supervisory meetings. So I was just like, okay, I'm going to roll with it. And then I got like 2 years into the PhD. And then at that point, I think there was something, it ended up being like in social media, and I was like in the picture. And then my supervisor was like, are you still doing these tonight? And I was like, yeah. But I guess because I'd stayed on track, kind of just.
You're going to have a side hustle, right?
Well, yeah. Why not? Yeah, straight away from the start. So I managed to do the two concurrently. And I guess then a job came up at the university. And at that point, I just thought, you know, I'm ready for a little bit more work-life balance, a little bit more stability. And sort of made the transition to the university. But I think the opportunities and success in certain areas I've got the university now wouldn't have come about from doing all the applied work I've done, because that's led to connections back in those environments. Like, I still do a lot of work with Leeds United now, but in a different capacity of running their internship program, having embedded PhD students within the club. So all those connections across, you know, from my time there, and then my time playing football in the women's game, has led to like opportunities that now link with the university. So in a weird and strange way, it's all connected and worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is good.
That's amazing. And when going back to the days when you were at Leeds, like, you were in a man's world, I'm guessing.
100%.
Like, was it just you?
Starting off, in terms of a football, as in, there was people in like education roles and those kind of things, but there was nobody in like my role where you were like directly working with the players. So first of all, like, I owe, you know, a huge thanks to who was the first team sports scientist at the time, like Matthew Pears, who's now sort of in Hong Kong with their national association, but for even giving me a chance, because mm-hmm. I know there was some people even questioning him, like, oh, is it really right to bring like a female into those environments, you know, with the players? I'm not really sure it fits and those kind of things. And, you know, luckily Matt was open-minded enough to kind of, you know, say, no, I think she was the best candidate. I'm going to give her kind of a chance. And then also a huge, huge amount to Neil Redfern, who was actually under 18s coach. And I went to the academy manager. I was so nervous, and I was up at the club, and it was on my second day, and the academy manager got sacked, and Neil Redfern, who was the 18s coach, had to take the, not just the under 18s, but the reserves. So these are obviously full-time professional male footballers. And he just came into the office to Matt and was like, I'm a coach down. Can I take Stacey out as the intern? And then that was the start of what led to a full-time job and everything. So, you know, there was probably a lot of people questioning why they were bringing a female into that role, but I have, you know, huge, huge amount to thank to both Matt and Neil for kind of like breaking down that barrier really for me and like giving me that opportunity.
I think that's so important that, yeah, you picked on that, because questions that I guess a lot of guys have is, how do we get women into mm-hmm. these industries? And I've had similar experience where it's just taken one male ally.
Yeah.
And it makes a massive difference, because it gives you that bit of confidence. And actually, it gives you the confidence to get into perhaps a culture that still needs to shift a lot. But it just takes one person for you to go, ah, do you know what? I'm going to give this a go. And then you're in it, then you're rolling, aren't you? And you roll with the punches, and you
yeah,
figure what
absolutely.
Works for you. In the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, male footballers, like, ego. like, I'm not going to say Premiership because I'm no leader in the Premiership. Sorry, Leeds. Yeah, awkward. But yeah, like how my perception would be, it can be pretty brutal.
Yeah, no, I can imagine what it's good. Yeah. No, I think, do you know what? Like, I have, again, that was probably, in all honesty, kind of, I was quite nervous going in that respect. But other than probably one or two players who, it wasn't unique to me as a female, they were just hard to handle, big egos, whatever, across all staff, right, the male staff as well. Do you know, I'd never had any issues with the players. It was never the players. I first started, obviously, like with the under-18s, younger boys, they were great. Like, it was almost like, I think for them, you know, they maybe haven't got to kind of that level kind of yet, but they were brilliant. And then obviously some of them progressed into like the 21s and beyond. And the players were brilliant. We had some changes in management and ownership and things like that at the club. And there was definitely challenging times with those. You had a scenario delivering, it was the reserve team, so a mix of actually first team players who needed some extra minutes and some younger professionals playing a game, and had a scenario where he was driving into kind of like training ground, playing on the front pitch, stopped his car and shouted out across the pitch, like, what the F is the girl doing on the pitch? To the point, like, I'm like, oh my God, like, what's going on? But kind of trying to still run the warm-up. And I had senior pros who were basically like, just ignore him. Like, the players were really good.
Yeah.
The club weren't in a good spell at that point. He then decided to tell senior people, like other people, like, he'd realised what the problem was. The players were distracted because it was a female. I was like, I really don't think I'm much of a distraction to the players. I really don't think that's the issue why we're not winning. But what was, I guess, out of that really positive again was, you know, I had the support of other male allies, like in the club, who, like, you know, gave a good advocate for kind of work I was doing and like how the players responded to that, and actually had players who, like, wrote statements to kind of say what happened, that if it did escalate, like, they would happily sort of come forward for that scenario. So I think, yeah, players sometimes get a bad rep, and sometimes for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of being a female in that environment, I've never had issues with the players that have been related to being my females. It's just mainly been management.
Do you know what? I can relate to that. So a lot of people say to me, like, what, when I was working construction, what, you know, did you get a lot of like stress and comments off the younger guys? It sounds very similar in that actually the younger generation don't see these issues, yeah, of having women. I always had an issue with white middle-aged man, 40s to 50s.
Definitely, yeah.
In a power.
Yeah.
And I think now it's coming out in the media that these power positions of that generation, 90%, it's them. Like, you've got young players on phenomenal amounts of money,
oh, yeah,
with, you know, social media all over them. They are, you know, kind of put on a pedestal, but actually they're not the problem.
Yeah, no, 100% can relate to that. And, you know, some of them now, like, you know, gone on and they're playing, you know, a big clubs.
Premier League. Don't say proper team.
No, what's that? You know, big clubs playing, yeah, international football, those kind of things. And randomly, was at St. George's Park in the last men's international window, and, you know, bumped into one and was just as same as he was when he was like 16, 17.
Nice.
You know, I don't think the players are the issues. And what I really hope, and I think you are starting to see it in the game now, because there is, you know, when I was having those experiences, you're talking, you know, about 7, 8 years ago, are seeing now more and more females in roles within the game that particularly relate to, you know, sports science, coaching, those kind of areas. And I do hope that as this younger generation of males who have come through the game and had some females in around it, they progress into coaching and leadership management roles, that again, it's just kind of, you know, it is already norm for them, and
yeah,
that's what they'll go with. Like, in the role now with Leeds Beckett, I have a few club men's clubs where, we, as I said, you kind of have PhD students embedded within that. And one of them, we interviewed, and there was a female again in the kind of in the candidates, and she actually came out top. And not only was she female, but she's South Korean and English, like, is a second language. And the head of performance was like, yeah, we want to pick her, we're going to take her. And another member of the staff on the panel was like, oh, I'm not really sure. Like, she's good, but is she going to fit into this environment, really? You know, like, I'm not sure what the people are going to think about it. And he was brilliant. He was like, look, I want the best people in my team. Like, that's what's going to drive us forward. She's the best person, so we're going to appoint her. Other people can just get over it and maybe become a bit more open-minded. And nice. I think having more and more males who are just like that in the game, I think it's important to recognise there's still challenges and barriers for women in the game. But I think we've also important at the same time we do, you know, celebrate that there are some good male advocates kind of out there for women in the game. And we don't all, you know, sometimes it's hard. I feel we get a little bit where we sort of like bash men a bit. And I think we've got to be careful that we find the balance in the middle because there is still challenges, but there's also quite a lot of, you know, good men out there who are, you know, trying to just advocate kind of getting the best person, whether they're, you know, male, female, whatever it
That's
is.
That's it, like, to strip the gender out of it, actually. Yeah. And I always say this when people, like, are like, oh, the construction industry was so bad. And I'm like, yeah, it was, but I wouldn't have stayed in it 17 years if it wasn't for the guys where the culture was incredible. And I think probably football might be quite similar in that the only way to change the culture is just for more women to show up.
Yeah.
And whilst it might be scary, they're on the path of helping to show others that, you know, only when you get into it can we start to change the culture, because it will just be second to none thinking, oh, it's just, it won't even be a thought of, oh, women in football.
Yeah.
Like, one of the, like, actually got me like really emotional when I was watching Ian Wright and everything kind of he had to say and the support that he gave when the English team were in the Euros and the World Cup. Like, that guy's passionate about women's football. And I was like, that's all it needs. Yeah. It's just a passion and a support. And then it can be elevated so far. But then also now the women that I see, you know, the commentators, everyone behind the scenes, it's like, why wasn't this ever, you know, it's a process, isn't it, of getting more people out there.
We'll get right back to our guests, but I'd wanted to give a big shout out to each and every one of you tuning in. Your downloads, subscriptions, and those shiny reviews you've been leaving, well, they're the heartbeat of She Who Dares Wins. Seriously, without your support, we wouldn't be here sharing these badass stories week after week. Now, here's the scoop. We're currently strutting our stuff without a sponsor, but hey, no sweat. You can keep this adventure alive. Swing by shewhodareswins.com and treat yourself to some empowering merch. Trust me, it's not just gear, it's a statement. And for those ultimate insiders, well, why not become a patron? Just £5 a month, and you're not just supporting the show, you're elevating it. We're talking secret bonus episodes with each guest, major discounts on all our merch, and a bunch of other goodies. You're not just a listener, you're a vital part of the tribe. Every bit of support fuels our mission to inspire and empower, so let's keep breaking barriers together. Stay daring, stay unstoppable. She Who Dares Wins. Let's get back to it.
But I know now you do work with women's teams, and they were quite involved, and you went out to the World Cup. How's the women's game getting on? How's that evolved since you started to like now?
Yeah, you can't even really compare it from kind of, I guess, when I was younger and playing and, you know, the opportunities then, and they just weren't, it just didn't exist. Like, I remember being like so happy that I got like £50 one month for like travel expenses. Like, it was like, oh my God, I'm finally getting paid to play football. And like now you kind of look at like the opportunities, the full-time contracts, and, you know, if I had a young girl now, like, and she told me like, I want to be a professional footballer, I'd be like, go for it. Like, that just didn't exist. So I think, you know, where it is now, it's just incredible. Yes, there's still work to be done. And, you know, while we say it's professional, certain contexts still aren't up to the standards they need to be. Or the support for female players in certain areas is still limited. But again, I think we've got to strive for more and push the people in power to kind of keep driving forward. But I think we've also got to, you know, remember where it's come from and that evolution, and it still takes time and it's got to be sustainable. Mm. So I know everyone, you know, not everyone, but people call for like, well, okay, you know, these top players might be getting paid £100,000 a year now, but a male player in the Premier League is getting £100,000 a week. Like, still not right. They should be getting the same. And it's like, well, it's got to be sustainable. Mm. So like, yes, you know, hopefully in the future you're getting the same. But we've got to get to the point where the women's game is bringing in as the same amount of money through media and those kind of avenues, sponsorships and those other things to make sure that that's sustainable. And I think that's kind of the key thing at the moment. But to see kind of, to go to the World Cup final this year and kind of see that, you know, full stadium, walk through Sydney, and just everything is branded for the Women's World Cup. And you've got, you know, not just young girls and women, but, you know, men, young boys, and they've got like the shirts on. I went to the fan park for the Sweden, Australia, like third, fourth playoff, and people were queuing from like 4 hours before. It was sold out from an hour before to get into. And went and stood up like on an elevated platform to kind of look down. It sounds a bit cheesy, but it was quite like just about just to think like, wow, this is like incredible to kind of see. So it's actually, you know, that opportunity wasn't there for me, and I was never going to be good enough to kind of play international football at that level. But it's really nice to be involved in the game now and actually to be able to like see young girls and women have those opportunities.
Yeah, and it's nice to just at grassroots level, like I drove past a local park and there was probably like three or four girls teams, and it's like, wow, like that, I never saw that as a kid. And it's great. I mean, like I said to you, it's a little bit frustrating that predominantly all the coaches are guys and dads, which is cool. Like you've got to get behind the team, but where do you think back of house, so like the teams behind the football clubs, is that still quite male dominated, or is that also changing as well at the same pace as the game?
I think it's changing, but not at the same pace. So I think while going back to like professional sport and men's sport, you know, it's great, more and more opportunity for females in, you know, physiotherapy, medical, sports science, S&C, all these kind of roles. But the biggest area yet that hasn't evolved is coaching.
Right.
So obviously you don't have any females that are assistants or managers like in the Championship, Premier League, anything like that on the men's side. There are sort of initiatives through the FA that are being introduced now where, you know, there are females sort of becoming members of staff in boys' academies and those kind of things, but not necessarily kind of like at first team level. I think it's Brentford, who one of the international England youth coaches on the women's game, she's actually now the under-18 head coach. So it is starting slowly, but I still think that's probably got, you know, another at least maybe 5-10 years before that really starts to progress. I know Serena Wiegmann's come out and kind of stated, I think it was last week, she's like, it's crazy why we're talking about like can a female coach in the men's game, like it's football. So
yeah,
if they can, you know, if they can coach a women's team, then of course you can go coach the men's team.
Yeah.
But I still think that's the biggest area that still needs to evolve is coaching. When we're getting more females in the game, and I think the more, you know, the likes of Serena, and then there's Emma Hayes and other female coaches that are becoming, you know, more visible to younger female coaches, that encourages them to kind of want to take that as a career, then hopefully the number of female coaches at a higher level is increasing. But I still think that's going to take time till it kind of just becomes, okay, who's the best candidate as a coach for this role, whether it's male or female, particularly in the men's game. I think there's still some work to do in getting more actual female coaches in there.
So if there's anyone like listening to this now who, or moms out there who've got daughters and they want to get into the industry, whether that be to play football or to become kind of back of house, what do you think it was, what did you learn about your journey that you think others can benefit from, i.e. like the little baby steps that get you into the industry? Is it just go ahead and do it, or, you know, would you have any advice for those people?
Yeah, no, good question. I think probably reaching out to probably what's their local, like county FA, and finding out, you know, what courses there are and those kind of things. Some of them you can kind of get on free, those just initial kind of like CPD kind of courses, and then progress. The FA starting to run more and more like scholarship programs and those kind of things in coaching. So probably just reaching out in the first instance to those. I think I just tried to make myself as rounded as possible. Like, so while my area is more sports science, I did my coaching badges as well. Like my initial instance at the time, probably for the wrong reasons a little bit, was to kind of prove that I knew the game as well. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I'm sports science, I'm female, but, you know, I'm going to do my UEFA B license and those kind of things. So when I'm in those rooms and it's male coaches, it's like, okay, well, I have my coaching licenses too. But now, even within sort of sports science fitness coach roles, do some work with UEFA, and they're bringing out now the new UEFA fitness diploma, and you also have to have your coaching badge alongside that. So that's actually worked out like in my favour kind of doing that. But I think that's probably did it for the wrong reasons, rather than just being like, I want to, you know, develop my knowledge of music. I was just more like, I'll show you men that like, I know the game, just like you do by doing the badges. But again, I went on the, you know, the course, and what was interesting was I managed to get on the course through the PFA, which is the Men's Professional Football Association, which all professional players were signed to. And again, another good male ally was a player in the men's first team. He was transitioning to be a coach. And while the players are great, they are a bit needy because they get everything done from them, like absolutely everything. So the thought for him of like going on a course in a summer on his own, not knowing anybody, didn't really like the idea of it. So I was like, well, I want to do my B license as well. But like at the time, I was doing a master's, didn't really have much money or anything like that. And it was like £500 to do it. And he was like, well, if you'll come with me, I'll pay for it. So I was like, okay, win-win.
Well, that's cool.
So I went on the B license through the PFA, managed to get on because I was at Leeds United, obviously only female. The rest of these like male professional footballers coming towards the end of their career. But again, kind of doing it that way, great opportunity to network. And then he's gone on to be a director of football in a professional club.
Wicked.
And then managed to set up like opportunities through now Leeds Beckett, PhDs and things like that. So it all kind of small world. And so I think it's that networking as well as kind of like, you know, getting the relevant qualifications as well.
Have you ever doubted yourself? Have you ever been in a situation, like say, when you're in the room, it's full of guys, you know, it's a big industry, there's a lot of eyes on. Have you ever had those situations where, like, I call them the mental breakdown because I've had a few in a porta cabin, loo or toilet. Have you had any of those and how have you got through them?
Yeah, no, I probably say I have daily. I think I would say I probably, struggle with probably imposter syndrome in like all like loads of different scenarios, not just when I was in men's football, but now opportunities like UEFA, FIFA, those kind of things that I'm like, God, like, not really sure what I'm doing in this room, those kind of things. I think it's a tough one. And I think in my experience, females struggle with it probably more than males. I think males struggle with it as well at times and maybe just don't talk about it as much. Yeah. But I think definitely probably doubt myself a lot of times in all honesty in scenarios like that. But I think it's then coming back to kind of like remembering the experiences I have got through, you know, not just in women's football, but across the game in general. And then probably, you know, thinking more about like what strengths do I bring to those kind of areas and trying to kind of balance that with promoting other people. I think probably my role now, and it's kind of escalated quite quickly, I think, with the growth of the women's game, probably escalated more into like leading projects and leading partnerships and those kind of things quite quickly off the back of just even finishing my own PhD and moving into academia. And I think that was a struggle in itself in terms of not really having any formal training in like leadership and just probably my own experiences of how other people have, you know, done that in terms of leading me and what's gone well and what hasn't. And probably just trying to advocate being somebody who's, I guess, promoting other people. Mm-hmm. So at times then when I have to go and present and go, oh, this is our project. And I kind of feel that like imposter syndrome of like, well, yeah, I'm kind of leading this project, but there's like three other people who are like, you know, 60 hours a week working on this PhD and I'm stood up here kind of presenting it, taking the credit for it. And that, like, those are scenarios probably where I just like have the biggest, like imposter syndrome and just like, oh my God, what am I doing?
When the reality is you've got so much to back up that, like your experiences and what you bring to the table through, starting out in America through to now, I imagine that the insight you can give is, well, it's incredible, which is why you get, you know, to work with the...
I'm very grateful for kind of like the opportunities that have come off it, like working with England and the youth teams and then UEFA. I guess what I'm trying to do now is, I guess, feed a little bit of that like back in for, you know, not just women, but, you know, men as well, opportunities in the game. So it was interesting when I was in Australia, I was speaking to someone out there, quite high profile. And she said to me, do you know what the biggest threat to women's football is? And I said, what? And she said, women. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And she's like, well, in the men's game, there's this, you know, quite a jobs for the boys kind of approach. She's like, still, I think women have a bit of that mentality of like, I've had to fight so hard to get here. I'm going to protect my kind of space. And they're not as open to like promoting other women within it. So I think probably that's the biggest thing I'm trying, hopefully, might not always get it right, but trying to do is like trying to promote, you know, the next kind of younger females coming into the game and trying to help them along the way.
Oh, there's some deep psychology in there. like, I, yeah, lift, like, is it lowering the ladder or lifting the ladder?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
hadn't really thought about it like that until she said it. And then I was like, actually, yeah, I can probably think about a few experiences I've had and, you know, maybe, yeah, like that actually does make sense.
You protect what you've built. Yeah, it's hard, actually. Yeah. And you do see it a lot. You see, I think in business, I've looked to reach out for mentors in the past, and actually guys have been a bit more open than some of the women. That's interesting. And it's good that you know that, because then you're like, how do we switch this up? So it's not only getting more women in, but making sure those at the top are there to support those coming through.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And kind of having that, you know, approach of, I try and view it as like, you know, hopefully you're recruiting someone who's better than you. Like, that's the whole idea, is kind of like probably how I see my role in some of those projects now, is like trying to be a facilitator for them. Like, they bring whole new skill sets, new ideas and those kind of things. And I guess in leading some of those partnerships and projects, it's like my role is to kind of help them kind of elevate that forward. I think I've struggled a lot with, particularly in like sports science, there's been so much evolution in like AI and coding and all those kind of things. And I think when you kind of trying to balance this, being a practitioner, still coaching, working in teams, managing projects, research strategies and these kind of things, it's really hard to try and stay current in all those kind of areas, and trying to become comfortable with, it's okay not to kind of maybe be at the forefront of coding and things now. Like, that's what this new generation of like practitioners, PhD students are doing coming through. And then my skill set or role now sits in that. It's like, how do I get the best out of them, manage the overall project direction and those things, but let those guys get on with kind of that work.
Yeah.
But then the challenge becomes then, like, I want to make sure they get credit for kind of what they've done. And it's not just me going, look, we've done all this fancy analysis and this kind of thing, and kind of take their credit. So it's just, that's probably the challenging part I find at the moment.
But I guess your awareness of knowing to do that is the first obstacle completely.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. Yeah. And then just, yeah, trying to figure out, hopefully we do it as much as possible, like take, you know, the other guys where we can to, you know, events with particularly the FA, and then hopefully UEFA and FIFA and things moving forward, so that's their platform and opportunity as well to, you know, accelerate their career, and hopefully I can be to them what I had in the male allies at the start, of just kind of giving them the platform to hopefully then forge their own career path kind of within the game.
Yeah. If there was just one thing that you wish, like, I guess you could just flick a switch and change within, you know, football for women, what would that be?
That's a good question.
I know. I probably should have given that one before the interview, because I feel like that came from a big space. Yeah. Or like, just the one thing. Or like, what are you like super passionate about? Is it that lifting the ladder, or is it pushing the game forward?
I think pushing the game forward. I think, yes, the game's professional now and females have professional contracts and those kind of things. But I think once you get beyond the surface, there's still loads of issues. Whether that's like infrastructure, resources, like job security, that, you know, those kind of things, balances of, you know, females who want to try and have a family alongside still be a footballer and a career, all those things to consider. And then probably what's been prevalent off the back of the World Cup is obviously ACLs, injuries, those kind of things. And like, I don't think the provision for female players is still where it needs to be. So currently working with a few big organizations to try and look at some like global projects around ACL injury risk reduction and those kind of things. So I think this, it's still across that like infrastructure, resource and professionalization of the game. We say it's professionalized, but once you get below that surface, there's a lot of disparity between a team that's top of the league in the women's Super League versus a team that's bottom of the WSL, and then as soon as you drop down another level to the Championship and below, then those differences become bigger and bigger.
Massive,
I still think there's probably a lot of work to do. There's a lot of good work being done and a lot of good people trying to sort of move the game forward. But I think if we settled and said we'd done it, you know, we'd done the job and the job was done, then we'd be doing a disservice to the current female players and then hopefully, you know, the future younger girls coming through.
Yeah, I think like the one thing I think we chatted about was, you know, well, for example, the shorts. So the whole idea of like, I watched the whole like the Euros and then the World Cup, and I was like, these girls are doing, not once did I think, oh, what would it be like to be like on your period playing, or like, you know, with, there was a home, and then you're having to wear the shorts and you're on a world platform and they're white shorts.
Yeah.
And it was just a simple thing. I thought somebody's not given thought to that. And that these big brands, I guess it is frustrating that the brands now that transition from the men's game to the women's game, it's almost like a given, like, oh, we'll do it. But it does somewhat seem like a, oh, okay, we'll just, we'll, you know, we'll move into the women's game. Like, for example, Nike, like Mary Earps, like an amazing player. And I'm not just saying that she's from Yorkshire. Like, incredible player. Like, and they didn't bring out a shirt for her. And it's, what does that then say to, and it's bullshit. Like, Nike have billions.
It's just good, but yeah, just they oversight.
They would have lost, they couldn't manufacture. Fuck off, like.
Well, then when they did, they sold out, didn't they? Within, like, I think it was 2 days or something like that.
Yeah,
like, and they had to even produce more.
Yeah, I was going to be like, do you know what? I'm the tiniest brand in the world, but I was going to be like, I'm going to make Mary Earps a shoe day as Wednesday.
Yeah, you should do.
And, like, I would have mass produced that. Like, God damn it. And it's interesting because I would hope that some more actual brands get to come in on this. Like, I know you've got the huge ones that already dominate the game, but I think there's space for, you know, new brands that can support women in different ways to step into that market and, you know, but just be more aligned with how we are different. Like, I know it's, we say we want to fight for the same space. We do want to fight for the same space, but we have different needs. And I'm guessing the research done in football on the physical side of things might be, have been predominantly in the past for men because the men's game was bigger.
Yeah, no doubt.
And then it's looking at female, you know, like, our bodies are different. I guess in aging and hormones, that all has an effect.
Yeah, no, there's definitely, so there's a few brands now that are starting to bring out female specific football boots. So that's one area that is starting to evolve. I know we are now doing with only England national teams, we're doing bra fittings.
Ah.
So around sports bras, and some of the brands are coming in and actually doing, you know, making them specific to the players. So
right,
those little areas are starting to evolve. But to your point there, it seems it's almost comes as an afterthought. It comes on the back of an issue versus kind of being, you know, at the forefront of, like, okay, how do we make this specific to females? I think, you know, some of the more high-profile female players, like in the, like, England national team, and then some of the other national teams globally, are doing a good job of using their platform to sort of really highlight some of the issues, and hopefully that's starting to lead to some change. But those are just, you know, like you said, the short issue. It's just something that, like, I think the brands just don't even think of. Probably the main people in there are men, and just don't even think about, kind of, like, you know, what's that going to be like? And I think there's a few high profile female players coming out at the moment around, like, body image. Like, I still think that's an issue, like, in terms of obviously the nature of training. Being an athlete, you can have quite an athletic body, but I still think probably from a commercial marketing perspective, there's still this perception of females of, like, what is this ideal body image and those kind of things. And I know some female athletes struggle with that, of, like, that competing, I guess, scenario of they want to kind of be at the pinnacle of their sport, and that requires them to probably train a certain way, which will have certain effects on the body, being very athletic, but maybe that doesn't fit with then how they want to be perceived in the social space.
Interesting.
So that's quite a space, you know, obviously mainly what I'm working is football, but working rugby as well. And I know that has been a huge issue of having girls, like, before the World Cup last year. We were trying to get quite a few of them stronger, and they were like, well, you know, yeah, my rugby's getting better, but put a dress on at the weekend and I just, you know, don't look very girly, like, yeah, those kind of things. So there's those kind of issues as well that I still think are to be addressed in the game.
Yeah, a lot of it's very interesting. There's so many different elements that need to be looked at.
Yeah,
and it's good that there is awareness. On the kit side of things, we were harping, like, oh my God, baby. But I was going to this classic, okay, what, I love the kits, and I think for young girls to get into the industry, it's really important that they get excited about, you know, wearing their favourite player kits. And when England rolled out, I don't know if it was the World Cup or the Euros, and, like, the kit was cool, and then the jacket was like this, like, pink, and I was just like, I don't know why, but, like, I do hate pink, but I was like, come on, just there's a million different colours, like, purple, like, where did the pink come from? And I'm like, was there someone on the team that was just like, it's women, so we've got to put the pink over?
I know, we joke, God. Like, I don't know if you've seen the staff kit, because we, obviously, the senior team, I work with the 19s, so fitness coach for the the women's 19s team, but when we got the kit, we were like, we look like, you know, the sweets, the squishies.
Yes.
We were like, we were like, we literally just look like squishies. Like, who has designed this kit?
So, but, do the players ever have, would the England team would have sat down with the people that designed this and been like, this is what?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I don't think the players will have really had much say in that. I'm not really sure who drives the design. Like, previously, before that, wasn't it? They had black kind of before that, and then before that was like a purple, and they were quite cool. And some of, I guess, the casual kit that the seniors had for kind of when they were in the World Cup, wearing around the hotel and when they were traveling, was good. But yeah, who thought this like salmon pink with blue? I mean, I don't really think salmon pink goes with blue anyway. Not that I'm really, I'm, you know, fashionista or anything like that, but it doesn't really go to start with.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, breaking down some of those images, I'm not sure that was probably the best choice of colour.
Yeah, it was a classic, like, no, the one thing that everyone says is don't bring something out in pink. They want something out in pink. But yeah, pulling away from that, like, they did an amazing job. And both teams were absolutely, I got so excited and so emotional as well. I was just like,
I think the Euros for me was the most emotional. I think obviously it was a home Euros, and I think probably, yeah, didn't know the extent to probably the impact that would have, but knew it would have a big impact kind of on the women's game.
Yeah,
that was definitely, I cried at the final whistle in the final, because I suppose some other people be the, you know, game, and people older than me who had even greater struggles than I had, and I think that was quite a like monumental moment for the women's game in this country, and just to see how many people were talking about it and those kind of things. After the Euro finals, it was only about 4 or 5 weeks after, and it was another international window, which was the start of like World Cup qualifiers. And I was at St. George's Park with the under-19s team. The senior team were there as well, training. And we were playing an under-18 boys college team, which we sometimes play boys teams just for pace of the game as like a training. And I think what was like a key moment was some of the seniors had finished training. They came to watch our game against the boys. And as we finished, the boys were looking around, oh my God, there's Lauren Hemp in the stand over there. There's Leo Williamson. And like, genuinely, he's like, excited. You know, boys that are like 17, 18, really excited to want to go over and get their picture taken or autograph with like some of the seniors. And I think that again was like quite an impactful moment, just to stand there and kind of watch that and just think, you know, yeah, these girls have done amazing. And like, this is hopefully going to change the game, you know, the impact they're going to have on so many young girls now and the opportunities that they're going to have.
And for us olders as well, I say also, just dragging them, like, we're old now, Stacey. But for me, it was emotional because, and I think there is the older generation who didn't get those opportunities. Yeah. I always said to Tom, I'd be in the England team. He was like,
what position would you be?
Long shot. Well, I got played in defence and I hated defence, like, but I didn't have the stamina to be. Yeah. I always liked being on the wing. But he was like, man, I've seen your throw-ins. I actually got like taken out of the game because I was too aggressive at one point. We won't get into my non-existent career. But I think it's nice now to see it so that, because if it hadn't have moved forward, it's just a frustration, isn't it?
Yeah, like, no, absolutely.
It's incredible. And I'm so glad that you're, you know, part of the industry and taking on that journey, because you have so much to give. And you've given me such a great insight into your world and your journey. And I think you're going to inspire so many people to listen to this, because you've shown that, you know, you just, that one little decision to go to America has like opened up this incredible career for you, and you're also now able to give back to others and show them that there is a space for women and there is a path. So yeah, thanks for that, and don't have imposter syndrome, because you totally belong where you are. Thanks so much for joining me today.
No, thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, it's been great.